Curiosity had come back along with his malice. Perhaps they were even the same thing. He gave one of his floppy nods and made an effort to brush his hair out of his eyes. His visitor entered timidly, as if there might be hidden mines under the floor. She was wearing a dress. Brady had never seen her in a dress, would have guessed she didn't even own one. But her hair was still cropped close to her skull in a half-assed crew cut, as it had been when they had worked together on the discount electronic cyber patrol, and she was still as flat as a board in front. He remembered some comedian's joke. If no tits count for shit, Cameron Diaz is going to be around for a long time. But she had put on a little powder to cover her pitted skin. Amazing. And even a dash of lipstick. More amazing still. In one hand, she held a wrapped package. "Hey, man," Freddy Linklater said with unaccustomed shyness. "How are you doing?" This opened all sorts of possibilities. Brady did his best to smile. BadConcert.com 1. Cora Babineau wipes the back of her neck with a monogram towel and frowns at the monitor in the basement exercise room. She has done only 4 of her 6 miles on the treadmill. She hates to be interrupted, and the weirdo is back. Cling-clong goes the doorbell, and she listens for her husband's footsteps above her, but there's nothing. On the monitor, the old man in the ratty parka, he looks like one of those bums you see standing at intersections holding up signs that say things like, "Hungry, no job, army veteran, please help," just stands there. "Damn it," she mutters, and pauses the treadmill. She climbs the stairs, opens the door to the back hallway, and shouts, "Felix, it's your weirdo friend, that Al!" No response. He's in his study again, possibly looking at the game thing he seems to have fallen in love with. The first few times she mentioned Felix's strange new obsession to her friends at the country club, it was a joke. It doesn't seem so funny now. He's 63, too old for kids' computer games and too young to have gotten so forgetful, and she's begun to wonder if he might not be suffering early-onset Alzheimer's. It has also crossed her mind that Felix's weirdo friend is some kind of drug pusher. But isn't the guy awfully old for that? And if her husband wants drugs, he can certainly supply himself. According to him, half the doctors at Kina are high at least half the time. Cling-clong goes the doorbell. "Jesus on a pony," she says, and goes to the door herself, growing more irritated with each long stride. She's a tall, gaunt woman whose female shape has been exercised nearly to oblivion. Her golf tan remains even in the depths of winter, only turning a pale shade of yellow that makes her look as if she's suffering chronic liver disease. She opens the door. The January night rushes in, chilling her sweaty face and arms. "I think I would like to know who you are," she says, "and what you and my husband are up to together. Would that be too much to ask?"
"Not at all, Mrs. Babineau," he says. "Sometimes I'm Al. Sometimes I'm Z-Boy. Tonight, I'm Brady. And boy, oh boy, it's nice to be out, even on such a cold night."
She looks down at his hand. "What's in that jar?"
"The end of all your troubles," says the man in the mended parka, and there's a muffled bang.
The bottom of the soda bottle blows out in shards, along with scorched threads from the steel wool. They float in the air like milkweed fluff. Cora feels something hit her just below her shrunken left breast and thinks, "This weirdo son of a bitch just punched me." She tries to take a breath, and at first can't. Her chest feels strangely dead. Warmth is pooling above the elastic top of her tracksuit pants. She looks down, still trying to take that all-important breath, and sees a stain spreading on the blue nylon. She raises her eyes to stare at the geezer in the doorway. He's holding out the remains of the bottle as if it's a present, a little gift to make up for showing up unannounced at 8 in the evening. What's left of the steel wool pokes out of the bottom like a charred boutonniere. She finally manages a breath, but it's mostly liquid. She coughs and sprays blood. The man in the parka steps into her house and sweeps the door shut behind him. He drops the bottle. Then he pushes her. She staggers back, knocking a decorative vase from the end table by the coat hooks, and goes down. The vase shatters on the hardwood floor like a bomb. She drags in another of those liquid breaths. I'm drowning, she thinks. Drowning. Right here in my front hall. And coughs out another spray of red.
Cora?
Babineau calls from somewhere deep in the house. He sounds as if he's just woken up.
Cora! Are you okay?
Brady raises Library Al's foot and carefully brings Library Al's heavy black work shoe down on the straining tendons of Cora Babineau's scrawny throat. More blood bursts from her mouth. Her sun-cured cheeks are now stippled with it. He steps down hard. There's a crackling sound as stuff breaks inside her. Her eyes bulge, bulge, and then they glaze over. You were a tough one, Brady remarks, almost affectionately. A door opens. Slippered feet come running, and then Babineau is there. He's wearing a dressing gown over ridiculous Hugh Hefner-style silk pajamas. His silver hair, usually his pride, is in wild disarray. The stubble on his cheeks has become an incipient beard. In his hand is a green Zap-It console from which the little fishing hole tune tinkles. By the sea, by the sea, by the beautiful sea. He stares at his wife lying on the hall floor. No more workouts for her, Brady says in that same affectionate tone. What did you do? Babineau screams, as if it isn't obvious. He runs to Cora and tries to fall to his knees beside her, but Brady hooks him under the armpit and hauls him back up. Library Al is by no means Charles Atlas, but he is ever so much stronger than the wasted body in room 217. No time for that, Brady says. The Robinson girl is alive, which necessitates a change of plan. Babineau stares at him, trying to gather his thoughts, but they elude him. His mind, once so sharp, has been blunted, and it's this man's fault. Look at the fish, Brady says. You look at yours, and I look at mine. We'll both feel better. No, Babineau says. He wants to look at the fish. He always wants to look at them now, but he's afraid to. Brady wants to pour his mind into Babineau's head like some strange water, and each time that happens, less of his essential self remains afterward. Yes, Brady says. Tonight you need to be Dr. Z.
I refuse.
You're in no position to refuse. This is coming unraveled. Soon the police will be at your door. Or Hodges. And that would be even worse. He won't read you your rights. He'll just hit you with that homemade sap of his. Because he's a mean motherfucker. And because you were right. He knows.
I won't. I can't.
Babineau looks down at his wife. Oh, God. Her eyes. Her bulging eyes.
The police would never believe. I'm a respected doctor. We've been married for 35 years.
Hodges will. And when Hodges gets the bit in his teeth, he turns into Wyatt fucking Earp. He'll show the Robinson girl your picture. She'll look at it and say, oh, wow, yes. That's the man who gave me the Zap-It at the mall. And if you gave her a Zap-It, you probably gave one to Janice Ellerton. Oops. And there's Scapelli. Babineau stares, trying to comprehend this disaster. Then there's the drugs you fed me. Hodges may know about them already, because he's a fast man with a bribe, and most of the nurses in the bucket know. It's an open secret. Because you never tried to hide it. Brady gives Library Al's head a sad shake. Your arrogance.
Vitamins,
It's all Babineau can manage. Even the cops won't believe that if they subpoena your files and search your computers. Brady glances down at Cora Babineau's sprawled body. And there's your wife, of course. How are you going to explain her?
I wish you'd died before they brought you in, Babineau says. His voice is rising, becoming a whine. Or on the operating table. You're a Frankenstein.
Don't confuse the monster with the creator, Brady says, although he doesn't actually give Babineau much credit in the creation department. Dr. B's experimental drug may have something to do with his new abilities, but it had little or nothing to do with his recovery. He's positive that was his own doing, an act of sheer willpower. Meanwhile, we have a visit to make, and we don't want to be late. To the man-woman. There's a word for that. Babineau used to know it, but now it's gone, like the name that goes with it, or what he ate for dinner. Each time Brady comes into his head, he takes a little more when he leaves. Babineau's memory, his knowledge, his self. That's right, the man-woman, or to give her sexual preference its scientific name, Rugus Munchus. No. The whine has become a whisper. I'm going to stay right here. Brady raises the gun, the barrel now visible within the blown-out remains of the makeshift silencer. If you think I really need you, you're making the worst mistake of your life. And the last one. Babineau says nothing. This is a nightmare, and soon he will wake up. Do it. Or tomorrow the housekeeper will find you lying dead next to your wife, unfortunate victims of a home invasion. I would rather finish my business as Dr. Z. Your body is 10 years younger than Brooks, and not in bad shape. But I'll do what I have to. Besides, leaving you to face Kermit Hodges would be mean of me. He's a nasty man, Felix. You have no idea. Babineau looks at the elderly fellow in the mended parka and sees Hartsfield looking out of Library Al's watery blue eyes. Babineau's lips are trembling and wet with spittle. His eyes are rimmed with tears. Brady thinks that with his white hair standing up around his head as it is now, the Babster looks like Albert Einstein in that photo where the famous physicist is sticking his tongue out.
How did I get into this?
He moans. The way everybody gets into everything, Brady says gently. One step at a time.
Why did you have to go after the girl? Babineau bursts out.
It was a mistake, Brady says. Easier to admit that than the whole truth. He couldn't wait. He wanted the nigger lawn boy's sister to go before anyone else blotted out her importance. Now stop fucking around and look at the fishies. You know you want to. And he does. That's the worst part. In spite of everything Babineau now knows, he does. He looks at the fish. He listens to the tune. After a while, he goes into the bedroom to dress and get money out of the safe. He makes one more stop before leaving. The bathroom medicine cabinet is well stocked on both her side and his. He takes Babineau's BMW, leaving the old Malibu where it is for the time being. He also leaves Library Al, who has gone to sleep on the sofa. 2. Around the time Cora Babineau is opening her front door for the last time, Hodges is sitting down in the living room of the Scott family's home on All Good Place, just one block over from T-Berry Lane where the Robinsons live. He swallowed a couple of painkillers before getting out of the car and isn't feeling bad, all things considered. Dinah Scott is on the sofa, flanked by her parents. She looks quite a bit older than 15 tonight because she's recently back from a rehearsal at Northside High School where the drama club will soon be putting on the Fantastics. She has the role of Louisa, Angie Scott has told Hodges, a real plum. This causes Dinah to roll her eyes. Hodges is across from them in a lazy boy, very much like the one in his own living room. From the deep divot in the seat, he deduces it is Carl Scott's normal evening roost. On the coffee table in front of the sofa is a bright green Zappit. Dinah brought it down from her room right away, which allows Hodges to further deduce that it wasn't buried under sports gear in her closet or left under the bed with the dust bunnies. It wasn't sitting forgotten in her locker at school. No, it was where she could lay her hands on it at once, which means she's been using it, old school or not. "I'm here at the request of Barbara Robinson," he tells them. "She was struck by a truck today."
"Oh, my God,"
Dinah says, a hand going to her mouth. "She's okay," Hodges says. "Broken leg is all. They're keeping her overnight for observation, but she'll be home tomorrow and probably back in school next week. You can sign her cast, if kids still do that."
Angie puts an arm around her daughter's shoulders.
"What does that have to do with Dinah's game?"
"Well, Barbara had one, and it gave her a shock. Based on what Holly told Hodges while he was driving over here, that's no lie. She was crossing a street at the time, lost her bearings for a minute, and bammo. A boy pushed her clear, or it would have been much worse."
"Jesus," Carl says.
Hodges leans forward, looking at Dinah. "I don't know how many of these gadgets are defective, but it's clear from what happened to Barb and a couple of other incidents we know of that at least some of them are."
"Let this be a lesson to you," Carl says to his daughter. "The next time someone tells you a thing's free, be on your guard."
This prompts another eye roll of the perfect teenage variety. "The thing I'm curious about," Hodges says, "is how you came by yours in the first place. It's kind of a mystery, because the Zappit company didn't sell many. They were bought out by another company when it flopped, and that company went bankrupt in April 2 years ago. You'd think the Zappit consoles would have been held for resale to help pay the bills."
"Or destroyed," Carl says. "That's what they do with unsold paperbacks, you know?"
"I'm actually aware of that," Hodges says. "So tell me, Dinah, how did you get it?"
"I went on the website," she says. "I'm not in trouble, am I? I mean, I didn't know. But Daddy always says ignorance of the law is no excuse."
"You're in zero trouble," Hodges assures her. "What website was this?"
"It was called badconcert.com. I looked for it on my phone when Mom called me at rehearsal and said you were coming over, but it's gone. I guess they gave away all the ones they had."
"Or found out that things were dangerous and folded their tents without warning anyone,"
Angie Scott says, looking grim.
"How bad could the shock be, though?" Carl asks. "I opened up the back when Dee brought it down from her room. There's nothing in there but 4 rechargeable double A's."
"I don't know about that stuff," Hodges says. His stomach is starting to hurt again in spite of the dope. Not that his stomach is actually the problem. It's an adjacent organ only 6 inches long. He took a moment after his meeting with Norma Wilmer to check the survival rate of patients with pancreatic cancer. Only 6% of them managed to live 5 years. Not what you'd call cheery news. "So far, I haven't even managed to reprogram my iPhone's text message alert so it doesn't scare innocent bystanders."
"I can do that for you," Dinah says. "Easy peasy. I have Crazy Frog on mine."
"Tell me about the website first."
"There was a tweet, okay? Someone at school told me about it. It got picked up on lots of social media sites. Facebook, Pinterest, Google+, you know the ones I'm talking about."
Hodges doesn't, but nods.
"I can't remember the tweet exactly, but pretty close. Because they can only be 140 characters long. You know that, right?"
"Sure," Hodges says, although he barely grasps what a tweet is. His left hand is trying to sneak its way to the pain in his side. He makes it stay put.
"This one said something like..."
Dinah closes her eyes. It's rather theatrical, but of course she just did come from a drama club rehearsal.
"Bad news. Some nut got the round here concert canceled. Want some good news? Maybe even a free gift? Go to badconcert.com.
She opens her eyes.
"That's probably not exact, but you get the idea."
"I do, yeah." He jots the website name in his notebook. "So you went there?"
"Sure. Lots of kids went there. It was kind of funny, too. There was a Vine of round here singing their big song from a few years ago, Kisses on the Midway, it was called. And after about 20 seconds, there's an explosion sound and this quacky voice saying, 'Oh, damn, show canceled.'"
"I don't think that's so funny," Angie says. You all could have been killed.
There must have been more to it than that, Hodges says.
Sure. It said that there were like 2,000 kids there, a lot of them at their first concert, and they got screwed out of the experience of a lifetime. Although, screwed wasn't the word they used.
I think we can fill in that blank, dear one, Carl says.
And then it said that Round Here's corporate sponsor had received a whole bunch of Zap-It game consoles, and they wanted to give them away to, you know, kind of make up for the concert.
Even though that was almost 6 years ago? Angie looks incredulous.
Yeah, kind of weird when you think of it.
But you didn't, Carl said. Think of it.
Dinah shrugs, looking petulant.
I did, but it seemed okay.
Famous last words, her father says.
So you just... What? Hodges asks. Emailed in your name and address and got that... He points to the Zap-It. In the mail?
There was a little more to it than that, Dinah says. You had to, like, be able to prove you were actually there. So I went to see Barb's mom, you know, Tanya.
Why?
For the pictures. I think I have mine somewhere, but I couldn't find them.
Her room, Angie says, and this time she's the one with the eye roll.
Hodges' side has picked up a slow, steady throb. What pictures, Dinah?
Okay, it was Tanya, she doesn't mind if we call her that, who took us to the concert, see? There was Barb, me, Hilda Carver, and Betsy.
Betsy would be...
Betsy DeWitt, Angie says. The deal was the moms drew straws to see who would take the girls. Tanya lost. She took Jenny Carver's van because it was the biggest.
Hodges nods his understanding.
So anyway, when we got there, Dinah says, Tanya took pictures of us. We had to have pictures. Sounds stupid, I guess, but we were just little kids. I'm into Mendoza Line and Ravenettes now, but back then Round Here was a really big deal to us, especially Cam, the lead singer. Tanya used our phones, or maybe she used her own, I can't exactly remember, but she made sure we all had copies, only I couldn't find mine.
You had to send a picture to the website as proof of attendance.
Right, by email. I was afraid the pics would only show us standing in front of Mrs. Carver's van, and that wouldn't be enough, but there were two that showed the Mingo Auditorium in the background with all the people lined up. I thought even that might not be good enough because it didn't show the sign with the band's name on it, but it was, and I got the Zap-It in the mail just a week later. It came in a big padded envelope.
Was there a return address?
Uh-huh. I can't remember the box number, but the name was Sunrise Solutions. I guess they were the tour sponsors.
It's possible that they were, Hodges thinks. The company wouldn't have been bankrupt back then, but he doubts it. Was it mailed from here in the city?
I don't remember.
I'm pretty sure it was, Angie says. I picked the envelope up off the floor and tossed it in the trash. I'm the French maid around here, you know.
She shoots her daughter a look.
Sorry,
Dinah says. In his notebook, Hodges writes, Sunrise Solutions, based NYC, but package mailed from here. When did all this go down, Dinah?
I heard about the tweet and went to the website last year. I can't remember exactly, but I know it was before the Thanksgiving break. And like I said, it came lickety-split. I was really surprised.
So you've had it for 2 months, give or take?
Yes.
And no shocks?
No, nothing like that.
Have you ever had any experiences where you were playing with it, let's say with the fishing hole game, and you kind of lost track of your surroundings? Mr. and Mrs. Scott look alarmed at this, but Dinah gives him an indulgent smile.
You mean like being hypnotized? Eeny, meeny, chili, beanie?
I don't know what I mean exactly, but okay, say that.
Nope, Dinah says cheerily. Besides, fishing hole is really dumb. It's for little kids. You use the joystick thingy beside the keypad to operate Fisherman Joe's net, see? And you get points for the fish you catch. But it's too easy. Only reason I checked back on that one is to see if the pink fish are showing numbers yet.
Numbers?
Yes. The letter that came with the game explained about them. I tacked it on my bulletin board because I'd really like to win that moped. Want to see it?
I sure would. When she bounces upstairs to get it, Hodges asks if he can use the bathroom. Once in there, he unbuttons his shirt and looks at his throbbing left side. It seems a little swollen and feels a little hot to the touch, but he supposes both of those things could be his imagination. He flushes the toilet and takes two more of the white pills. Okay, he asks, his throbbing side. Can you just shut up a while and let me finish here? Dinah has scrubbed off most of her stage makeup, and now it's easy for Hodges to imagine her and the other three girls at 9 or 10 going to their first concert and as excited as Mexican jumping beans in a microwave. She hands him the letter that came with the game. At the top of the sheet is a rising sun with the words Sunrise Solutions bent over it in an arc. Pretty much what you'd expect, only it doesn't look like any corporate logo Hodges has ever seen. It's strangely amateurish, as if the original was drawn by hand. It's a form letter with the girl's name plugged in to give it a more personal feel. Not that anybody's apt to be fooled by that in this day and age, Hodges thinks, when even mass mailings from insurance companies and ambulance-chasing lawyers come personalized.
Dear Dinah Scott, congratulations. We hope you will enjoy your Zap-It game console, which comes preloaded with 65 fun and challenging games. It is also Wi-Fi equipped, so you can visit your favorite internet sites and download books as a member of the Sunrise Readers Circle. You are receiving this free gift to make up for the concert you missed. But of course, we hope you will tell all your friends about your wonderful Zap-It experience. And there's more. Keep checking the fishing hole demo screen and keep tapping those pink fish, because someday, you won't know when until it happens, you will tap them and they will turn into numbers. If the fish you tap add up to one of the numbers below, you will win a great prize. But the numbers will only be visible for a short time. So keep checking. Add to the fun by staying in touch with others in the Zap-It Club by going to ztheend.com, where you can also claim your prize if you are one of the lucky ones. Thanks from all of us at Sunrise Solutions and the whole Zap-It team.
There was an unreadable signature, hardly more than a scribble. Below that,
lucky numbers for Dinah Scott. 1034 equals $25 gift certificate at Deb. 1781 equals $40 gift card at Atom Arcade. 1946 equals $50 gift certificate at Carmike Cinemas. 7459 equals Wave 50cc Moped Scooter, grand prize. You actually believed this bullshit? Carl Scott asks. Although the question is delivered with a smile, Dinah tears up. All right, I'm stupid, so shoot me. Carl hugs her, kisses her temple. Know what? I would have swallowed it at your age, too.
Have you been checking the pink fish, Dinah? Hodges asks.
Yes, once or twice a day. That's actually harder than the game because the pink ones are fast. You have to concentrate.
Of course you do, Hodges thinks. He likes this less and less. But no numbers, huh?
Not so far.
Can I take that? He asks, pointing to the Zap-It. He thinks about telling her he'll give it back later, but doesn't. He doubts if he will. And the letter?
On one condition, she says.
Hodges, pain now subsiding, is able to smile. Name it, kiddo.
Keep checking the pink fish, and if one of my numbers comes up, I get the prize.
It's a deal, Hodges says, thinking someone wants to give you a prize, Dinah, but I doubt very much if it's a moped or a cinema gift certificate. He takes the Zap-It and the letter and stands up. I want to thank you all very much for your time. Welcome, Carl says. And when you figure out just what the hell this is all about, will you tell us? You got it, Hodges says. One more question, Dinah, and if I sound stupid, remember that I'm pushing 70.
She smiles. At school, Mr. Morton says the only stupid question
is the one you don't ask, yeah. I've always felt that way myself, so here it comes. Everybody at Northside High knows about this, right? The free consoles, the number fish, and the prizes?
Not just our school. All the other ones, too. Twitter, Facebook, Pinterest, Yik Yak, that's how they work.
and if you were at the concert and you could prove it, you were eligible to get one of these.
Uh-huh.
What about Betsy DeWitt? Did she get one?
Dinah frowns. No, and that's kind of funny, because she still had her pictures from that night, and she sent one to the website. But she didn't do it as soon as I did. She's an awful procrastinator, so maybe they were all out. If you snooze, you lose type of thing.
Hodges thanks the Scots again for their time, wishes Dinah good luck with the play, and goes back down the walk to his car. When he slides behind the wheel, it's cold enough inside to see his breath. The pain surfaces again, 4 hard pulses. He waits them out, teeth clamped, trying to tell himself these new sharper pains are psychosomatic, because he now knows what's wrong with him, but the idea won't quite wash. 2 more days suddenly seems like a long time to wait for treatment, but he will wait. Has to, because an awful idea is rising in his mind. Pete Huntley wouldn't believe it, and Izzy James would probably think he needed a quick ambulance ride to the nearest funny farm. Hodges doesn't quite believe it himself, but the pieces are coming together. And although the picture that's being revealed is a crazy one, it also has a certain nasty logic. He starts his Prius and points it toward home, where he will call Holly and ask her to try and find out if Sunrise Solutions ever sponsored a Round Here tour. After that, he will watch TV. When he can no longer pretend that what's on interests him, he'll go to bed and lie awake and wait for morning. Only he's curious about the green Zap-It. Too curious, it turns out, to wait. Halfway between All Good Place and Harper Road, he pulls into a strip mall, parks in front of a dry cleaning shop that's closed for the night, and powers the gadget up. It flashes bright white, and then a red Z appears, growing closer and bigger until the slant of the Z colors the whole screen red. A moment later, it flashes white again, and a message appears.
Welcome to Zap-It. We love to play. Hit any key to begin, or just swipe the screen.
Hodges swipes, and game icons appear in neat rows. Summer console versions of ones he watched Allie play at the mall when she was a little girl. Space Invaders, Donkey Kong, Pac-Man, and that little yellow devil's mane squeeze, Ms. Pac-Man. There are also the various solitaire games Janice Ellerton had been hooked on, and plenty of other stuff Hodges has never heard of. He swipes again, and there it is, between Spell Tower and Barbie's Fashion Walk. Fishing Hole. He takes a deep breath and taps the icon.
Thinking about Fishing Hole, the screen advises.
A little worry circle goes around for 10 seconds or so. It seems longer. And then the demo screen appears. Fish swim back and forth, or do loop-the-loops, or shoot up and down on diagonals. Bubbles rise from their mouths and flipping tails. The water is greenish at the top, shading to blue farther down. A little tune plays, not one Hodges recognizes. He watches and waits to feel something. Sleepy seems the most likely. The fish are red, green, blue, gold, yellow. They're probably supposed to be tropical fish, but they have none of the hyper-reality Hodges has seen in Xbox and PlayStation commercials on TV. These fish are basically cartoons, and primitive ones at that. No wonder the Zap-It flopped, he thinks. But yeah, okay, there's something mildly hypnotic about the way the fish move. Sometimes alone, sometimes in pairs, every now and then in a rainbow school of 6. And jackpot, here comes a pink one. He taps at it, but it's moving just a mite too fast, and he misses. Hodges mutters, shit, under his breath. He looks up at the darkened dry-cleaning store's window for a moment because he really is feeling a trifle dozy. He lightly smacks first his left cheek and then his right with the hand not holding the game and looks back down. There are more fish now, weaving back and forth in complicated patterns. Here comes another pink one, and this time he succeeds in tapping it before it whisks off the left side of the screen. It blinks, almost as if to say, okay, Bill, you got me that time. But no number appears. He waits, watches, and when another pink one appears, he taps again. Still no number. Just a pink fish that has no counterpart in the real world. The tune seems louder now, and at the same time slower. Hodges thinks it really is having some kind of effect. It's mild and probably completely accidental, but it's there, all right. He pushes the power button. The screen flashes, "Thanks for playing. See you soon," and goes dark. He looks at the dashboard clock and is astonished to see he has been sitting here looking at the Zap-It for over 10 minutes. It felt more like 2 or 3. 5, at the very most. Dinah didn't talk about losing time while looking at the fishing hole demo screen, but he hadn't asked about that, had he? On the other hand, he's on 2 fairly heavy-duty painkillers, and that probably played a part in what just happened. If anything actually did, that is. No numbers, though. The pink fish had just been pink fish. Hodges slips the Zap-It into his coat pocket along with his phone and drives home. 3. Freddy Linklater, once a computer repair colleague of Brady's before the world discovered Brady Hartsfield was a monster, sits at her kitchen table, spinning a silver flask with one finger as she waits for the man with the fancy briefcase. Dr. Z is what he calls himself, but Freddy is no fool. She knows the name that goes with the briefcase initials, Felix Babineau, head of neurology at Kiner Memorial. Does he know that she knows? She's guessing he does, and doesn't care. But it's weird. Very. He's in his 60s, an authentic golden oldie, but he reminds her of somebody much younger, someone who is, in fact, this Dr. Babineau's most famous, infamous, really, patient. Around and around goes the flask. Etched on the side is GH and FL forever. Well, forever lasted just about 2 years, and Gloria Hollis has been gone for quite a while now. Babineau, or Dr. Z as he styles himself like the villain in a comic book, was part of the reason why. He's creepy, Gloria said. The older guy is too, and the money's creepy. It's too much. I don't know what they got you into, Fred, but sooner or later it's going to blow up in your face, and I don't want to be part of the collateral damage. Of course, Gloria had also met someone else, someone quite a bit better looking than Freddy, with her angular body and lantern jaw and pitted cheeks, but she didn't want to talk about that part of it. Oh, no. Around and around goes the flask. It all seemed so simple at first, and how could she refuse the money? She never saved much when she worked on the discount electronic cyber patrol, and the work she'd been able to find as an independent IT when the store closed had barely been enough to keep her off the street. It might have been different if she'd had what Anthony Frobisher, her old boss, liked to call people skills, but those had never been her forte. When the old geezer who called himself Z-Boy made his offer, and dear God, that was really a comic book handle, it had been like a gift from God. She had been living in a shitty apartment on the south side, in the part of town commonly referred to as Hillbilly Heaven, and a month behind on the rent in spite of the cash the guy had already given her. What was she supposed to do? Refuse $5,000? Get real. Around and around goes the flask. The guy is late. Maybe he's not coming at all, and that might be for the best. She remembers the geezer casting his eyes around the 2-room apartment, most of her possessions in paper bags with handles. All too easy to see those bags gathered around her as she tried to sleep beneath a crosstown expressway underpass. "You'll need a bigger place," he said. "Yeah, and the farmers in California need rain." She remembers peering into the envelope he handed her, remembers riffling the 50s and what a comfy sound they made. "This is nice. But by the time I get square with all the people I owe, there won't be much left." She could stiff most of those people, but the geezer didn't need to know that. "There'll be more, and my boss will take care of getting you an apartment where you may be asked to accept certain shipments." That started alarm bells ringing. "If you're thinking about drugs, let's just forget the whole thing." She held out the cash-stuffed envelope to him, much as it hurt to do that. He pushed it back with a little grimace of contempt. No drugs. You'll not be asked to sign for anything even slightly illegal.
So here she is, in a condo close to the lakeshore. Not that there's much of a lake view from only 6 stories up, and not that the place is a palace. Far from it, especially in the winter. You can only catch a wink of the water between the newer, nicer high-rises. But the wind finds its way through just fine, thanks, and in January that wind is cold. She has the joke thermostat cranked to 80 and is still wearing 3 shirts and long johns under her carpenter jeans. Hillbilly heaven is in the rearview mirror, though, that's something. But the question remains, is it enough? Around and around goes the silver flask, GH and FL forever. Only nothing is forever. The lobby buzzer goes, making her jump. She picks up the flask, her one souvenir of the glorious Gloria days, and heads to the intercom. She quashes an urge to do her Russian spy accent again. Whether he calls himself Dr. Babineau or Dr. Z, the guy is a little scary. Not hillbilly heaven crystal meth dope dealer scary, but in a different way. Better to play this straight, get it over with, and hope to Christ she doesn't find herself in too much trouble if the deal blows up in her face. Is this the famous Dr. Z? Of course it is. You're late. Am I keeping you from something important, Freddy? No, nothing important. Nothing she does is particularly important these days. You brought the money? Of course. Sounding impatient. The old geezer with whom she had commenced this nutty business had the same impatient way of speaking. He and Dr. Z looked nothing alike, but they sounded alike, enough to make her wonder if they weren't brothers. Only they also sounded like that someone else, the old colleague she used to work with, the one who turned out to be Mr. Mercedes. Freddy doesn't want to think about that any more than she wants to think about the various hacks she's done on Dr. Z's behalf. She hits the buzzer beside the intercom. She goes to her door to wait for him, taking a nip of scotch to fortify herself. She tucks the flask into the breast pocket of her middle shirt, then reaches into the pocket of the one beneath where she keeps her breath mints. She doesn't believe Dr. Z would give shit one if he smelled booze on her breath, but she always used to pop a mint after a nip when she was working at Discount Electronics, and old habits are strong habits. She takes her Marlboros from the pocket of her top shirt and lights one. It will further mask the smell of the booze and calm her a little more, and if he doesn't like her secondhand smoke, tough titty. This guy has set you up in a pretty nice apartment and paid you almost $30,000 over the last 18 months or so, Gloria had said. Tall tickets for something any hacker worth her salt could do in her sleep, at least according to you. So why you? And why so much? More stuff Freddy doesn't want to think about. It all started with the picture of Brady and his mom. She found it in the junk room at Discount Electronics, shortly after the staff had been told the Birchill Mall store was closing. Their boss, Anthony Tones Frobisher, must have taken it out of Brady's work cubby and tossed it back there after the world found out that Brady was the infamous Mercedes killer. Freddy had no great love for Brady, although they did have a few meaningful conversations about gender identity back in the day. Wrapping the picture and taking it to the hospital was pure impulse, and the few times she'd visited him afterwards had been pure curiosity, plus a little pride at the way Brady had reacted to her. He smiled.
"He responds to you," the new head nurse, Scapelli, said after one of Freddy's visits. "That's very unusual."
By the time Scapelli replaced Becky Helmington, Freddy knew that the mysterious Dr. Z who took over supplying her with cash was in reality Dr. Felix Babineau. She didn't think about that either. Or about the cartons that eventually began arriving from Terre Haute via UPS. Or the hacks. She became an expert in not thinking, because when she started doing that, certain connections became obvious. And all because of that damn picture. Freddy wishes now she'd resisted the impulse, but her mother had a saying, "Too late always comes too early." She hears his footsteps coming down the hall. She opens the door before he can ring the bell, and the question is out of her mouth before she knows she is going to ask it. "Tell me the truth, Dr. Z. Are you Brady?"
4. Hodges is barely inside his front door and still taking off his coat when his cell rings. Hey, Holly.
Are you all right?
He can see a lot of calls from her starting with this exact same greeting. Well, it's better than drop dead motherfucker. Yeah, I'm good.
One more day, and then you start treatments. And once you start, you don't stop. Whatever the doctors say, you do.
Stop worrying. A deal is a deal.
I'll stop worrying when you're cancer-free.
Don't, Holly, he thinks, and closes his eyes against the unexpected sting of tears. Don't, don't, don't.
Jerome is coming tonight. He called from his plane to ask about Barbara, and I told him everything she told me. He'll be in at 11 o'clock. A good thing he left when he did, because a storm is coming. It's supposed to be a bad one. I offered to rent him a car, the way I do for you when you go out of town. It's very easy now that we have the corporate account.
That you lobbied for until I gave in. Believe me, I know.
But he doesn't need a car. His father is picking him up. They'll go in to see Barbara at 8 tomorrow and bring her home if the doctor says she can go. Jerome said he can be at our office by 10, if that's okay.
Sounds fine, Hodges says, wiping his eyes. He doesn't know how much Jerome can help, but he knows it will be very good to see him. Anything more he can find out from her about that damn gadget?
I asked him to do that. Did you get Dinah's?
Yeah, and tried it. There's something up with the fishing hole demo screen, all right. It makes you sleepy if you look at it too long. Purely accidental, I think, and I don't see how most kids would be affected because they'd want to go right to the game. He fills her in on the rest of what he learned from Dinah. Holly says,
so Dinah didn't get her Zappit the same way as Barbara and the Ellerton woman?
No.
And don't forget Hilda Carver. The man calling himself Myron Zakum gave her one, too. Only hers didn't work. Barb said it just gave a single blue flash and died. Did you see any blue flashes?
Nope. Hodges is peering at the scant contents of his refrigerator for something his stomach might accept, and settles on a carton of banana-flavored yogurt. And there were pink fish, but when I succeeded in tapping a couple, which ain't easy, no numbers appeared.
I bet they did on Mrs. Ellerton's.
Hodges thinks so, too. It's early to generalize, but he's starting to think the number fish only show up on the Zappits that were handed out by the man with the briefcase, Myron Zakum. Hodges also thinks someone is playing games with the letter Z. And along with a morbid interest in suicide, games were part of Brady Hartsfield's modus operandi. Except Brady is stuck in his room at Kiner Memorial, goddammit. Hodges keeps coming up against that irrefutable fact. If Brady Hartsfield has stooges to do his dirt, and it's starting to seem that he does, how is he running them? And why would they run for him, anyway? Holly, I need you to heat up your computer and check something out. Not a biggie, just a T that needs to be crossed.
Tell me.
I want to know if Sunrise Solutions sponsored the Round Here tour in 2010 when Hartsfield tried to blow up the Mingo Auditorium. Or any Round Here tour.
I can do that. Did you have supper?
Taking care of that right now.
Good. What are you having?
Steak, shoestring potatoes, and a salad, Hodges says, looking at the carton of yogurt with a mixture of distaste and resignation. Got a leftover apple tart for dessert.
Heat it up in the microwave and put a scoop of vanilla ice cream on top. Yummy!
I'll take that under consideration. He shouldn't be amazed when she calls back 5 minutes later with the information he requested. It's just Holly being Holly, but he still is. Jesus, Holly, already. With no idea that she is echoing Freddie Linklater almost word for word, Holly says,
ask for something hard next time. You might like to know that Round Here broke up in 2013. Those boy bands don't seem to last very long.
No, Aja says. Once they start having to shave, the little girls lose interest.
I wouldn't know, Holly says. I was always a Billy Joel fan. Also, Michael Bolton.
Oh, Holly. Hodges mourns, and not for the first time.
Between 2007 and 2012, the group did 6 nationwide tours. The first 4 were sponsored by Sharp Cereals,
which gave out free samples at their concerts. The last two, including the one at the Mingo, were sponsored by PepsiCo.
No Sunrise Solutions?
No.
Thanks, Holly. I'll see you tomorrow.
Yes. Are you eating your dinner?
Sitting down to it now.
All right. And try to see Barbara before you start your treatments. She needs friendly faces, because whatever was wrong with her hasn't worn off yet. She said it was like it left a trail of slime inside her head.
I'll make sure of it, Hodges says, but that is a promise he's not able to keep. 5. Are you Brady? Felix Babineau, who sometimes calls himself Myron Zakim, and sometimes Dr. Z, smiles at the question. It wrinkles his unshaven cheeks in a decidedly creepy way. Tonight, he's wearing a furry ushanka instead of his trilby, and his white hair kind of squishes out around the bottom. Freddy wishes she hadn't asked the question, wishes she didn't have to let him in, wishes she'd never heard of him. If he is Brady, he's a walking haunted house. Ask me no questions, and I'll tell you no lies, he says. She wants to let it go and can't, because you sound like him. And that hack the other one brought me after the boxes came, that was a Brady hack if I ever saw one, good as a signature. Brady Hartsfield is a semi-catatonic who can barely walk, let alone write a hack to be used on a bunch of obsolete game consoles, some of which have proved to be defective as well as obsolete. I did not get my money's worth from those Sunrise Solutions motherfuckers, which pisses me off to the max. Pisses me off to the max. A phrase Brady used all the time back in their cyber patrol days, usually about their boss or some idiot customer who managed to spill a mocha latte into his CPU. You've been very well paid, Freddy, and you're almost done. Why don't we leave it at that? He brushes past her without waiting for a reply, puts his briefcase on the table, and snaps it open. He takes out an envelope with her initials, F.L., printed on it. The letters slant backward. During her years on the Discount Electronic Cyber Patrol, she saw similar back-slanted printing on hundreds of work orders. Those were the ones Brady filled out. 10,000, Dr. Z says. Final payment. Now go to work. Freddy reaches for the envelope. You don't need to hang around if you don't want to. The rest is basically automatic. It's like setting an alarm clock. And if you're really Brady, she thinks, you could do it yourself. I'm good at this stuff, but you were better. He lets her fingers touch the envelope, then pulls it back. I'll stay. Not that I don't trust you. Right, Freddy thinks. As if. His cheeks once more wrinkle in that unsettling smile. And who knows? We might get lucky and see the first hit. I'll bet most of the people who got those Zappets have already thrown them away. It's a fucking toy, and some of them don't even work, like you said. Let me worry about that, says Dr. Z. Once again his cheeks wrinkle and pull back. His eyes are red, as if he's been smoking the rock. She thinks of asking him what exactly they are doing and what he hopes to accomplish, but she already has an idea, and does she want to be sure? Besides, if this is Brady, what harm can it do? He had hundreds of ideas, all of them crackpot. Well, most of them. She leads the way into what was meant to be a spare bedroom and has now become her workstation, the sort of electronic refuge she always dreamed of and could never afford, a hidey hole that Gloria, with her good looks, infectious laugh, and people skills, could never understand. In here, the baseboard heaters hardly work at all, and it's 5 degrees colder than the rest of the apartment. The computers don't mind. They like it. Go on, he says. Do it. She sits down at the top-of-the-line desktop Mac with its 27-inch screen, refreshes it, and types in her password, a random collection of numbers. There's a file simply marked Z, which she opens with another password. The subfiles are marked Z1 and Z2. She uses a third password to open Z2, then begins to rapidly click away at her keyboard. Dr. Z stands by her left shoulder.
He's a disturbing, negative presence at first, but then she gets lost in what she's doing, as she always does. Not that it takes long. Dr. Z has given her the program, and executing it is child's play. To the right of her computer, sitting on a high shelf, is a Motorola signal repeater. When she finishes, by simultaneously hitting Command and the Z key, the repeater comes to life. A single word appears in yellow dots, searching. It blinks like a traffic light at a deserted intersection. They wait, and Freddy becomes aware that she's holding her breath. She lets it go in a whoosh, momentarily puffing out her thin cheeks. She starts to get up, and Dr. Z puts a hand on her shoulder. Let's give it a little longer. They give it 5 minutes. The only sound, the soft hum of her equipment, and the keening of the wind off the frozen lake. Searching blinks on and on. All right, he says at last. I knew it was too much to hope for. All things in good time, Freddy. Let's go back into the other room. I'll give you your final payment, and then be on my way. Searching in yellow suddenly turns to found. In green. There! He shouts, making her jump. There, Freddy! There's the first one! Her final doubts are swept away, and she knows for sure. All it takes is that shout of triumph. It's Brady, all right. He's become a living Russian nesting doll, which goes perfectly with his furry Russian hat. Look inside Babineau, and there's Dr. Z. Look inside Dr. Z, and there, pulling all the levers, is Brady Hartsfield. God knows how it can be, but it is. Found in green is replaced with loading in red. After mere seconds, loading is replaced with task complete. After that, the repeater begins to search again. All right, he says. I'm satisfied. Time for me to go. It's been a busy night, and I'm not done yet. She follows him into the main room, shutting the door to her electronic hideaway behind her. She has come to a decision that's probably long overdue. As soon as he's gone, she's going to kill the repeater and delete the final program. Once that's done, she'll pack a suitcase and go to a motel. Tomorrow, she's getting the fuck out of the city and heading south to Florida. She's had it with Dr. Z and his Z-boy sidekick and winter in the Midwest. Dr. Z puts on his coat, but drifts to the window instead of going to the door.
Not much of a view. Too many high-rises in the way.
Yeah, it sucks the big one.
Still, it's better than mine, he says, not turning.
All I've had to look at for the last 5.5 years is a parking garage. Suddenly, she's at her limit. If he's still in the same room with her 60 seconds from now, she'll go into hysterics.
Give me my money, give it to me, and then get the fuck out. We're done.
He turns. In his hand is the short-barreled pistol he used on Babineau's wife. You're right, Freddy. We are. She reacts instantly, knocking the pistol from his hand, kicking him in the groin, karate chopping him like Lucy Liu when he doubles over, and running out the door while screaming her head off. This mental film clip plays out in full color and Dolby sound as she stands rooted to the spot. The gun goes bang. She staggers back 2 steps, collides with the easy chair where she sits to watch TV, collapses across it, and rolls to the floor, coming down head first. The world begins to darken and draw away. Her last sensation is warmth above as she begins to bleed, and below as her bladder lets loose. Final payment, as promised. The words come from a great distance. Blackness swallows the world. Freddy falls into it and is gone. 6. Brady stands perfectly still, watching the blood seep from beneath her. He's listening for someone to pound on her door, wanting to know if everything is all right. He doesn't expect that will happen, but better safe than sorry. After 90 seconds or so, he puts the gun back in his overcoat pocket next to his zappet. He can't resist one more look into the computer room before leaving.
The signal repeater continues its endless automated search. He has, against all odds, completed an amazing journey. What the final results will be is impossible to predict, but that there will be some result, he is certain.